Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we have a conversation with Joey Deoria, the guy who played TV's Bozo the Clown in Chicago for 17 years. We celebrate Twinkie's upcoming 75th anniversary and hear about the Twinkie cookbook that's in the works. We learn about a couple of low-powered radio stations starting up in the Champaign-Urbana area, and we remember singer-songwriter Jolie Rickman. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Twinkie, that well-known yellow sponge cake with a cream filling, is celebrating its 75th anniversary. In honor of this, the folks at Hostess, the company that makes Twinkies, is coming out with a Twinkie cookbook. I talked recently with Teresa Cogswell, Hostess's Blue Ribbon baking expert and spokesperson for the upcoming cookbook. I asked her first, what does it take to be a Blue Ribbon Twinkie baking expert?
Well, I've been baking since I was probably 6 years old and then decided to do it as a profession. So I guess if you do it long enough and you get good enough, then you can be the expert.
Well, how do you become an expert at Twinkies?
Well, I've been working for the owners of the Twinkie brand for about the last 13 or 14 years. So I know Twinkies very well and have done a lot of different things with Twinkies.
So why do you think the Twinkie has become such an icon of America and American dessert?
I think the Twinkie is an icon in America because it's simplistic. It's a piece of yellow sponge cake filled with cream filling, and it lends itself to people who like simple things. And you can take it and dress it up and make it more fashionable, if you will, if you want to create a new recipe. And it's just a nice snack. And it, relatively, for a nice snack, it's relatively low calories, only 160 calories.
Now, Twinkie is celebrating their 75th anniversary, which is hard to believe.
It is, but it's 75 years old.
And in honor of that, you're coming out with a cookbook.
We are. We're going to memorialize the best Twinkie chefs in America in a Twinkie cookbook, and you can enter that at Twinkies.com, and the sky's the limit. If you use them as part of a dessert recipe, or you use them as part of, we actually had a little 11-year-old boy who used one as part of his main dish. I can't let the cat out of the bag, but it was kind of interesting. People use them for all sorts of things. We want them to share them at Twinkies.com.
Well, you have some recipes in there already, and you can't share any of them?
Oh, I can share some of them that we have on the website, but this particular 11-year-old boy had a very unique way, kind of used it as a bun.
Sort of like a Twinkie hot dog?
There you go. You know, you just never know.
Wow. So, okay, so tell me some of your favorite recipes, and I'm sure, you know, most of them are desserts, but are there a few that, I mean, I'm sure, is there a Twinkie soup? Is there a Twinkie salad? I mean, tell me some of the more interesting ones.
Well, one of my favorites is called the Twinkie Beauty Shake. You know, smoothies are real big right now, and this particular recipe takes Twinkie, soy or regular milk, vanilla, honey or your favorite fruit spread, a ripe banana, and 4 ice cubes. And you can add protein powder if you're feeling real healthy. And you blend that all together, and it gives you, this particular person calls it a beauty shake, great for your skin and works super for meals on the go or after exercising.
You know, I like Twinkies, and I've eaten my share, but a blended Twinkie, I don't know if that really does it for me. That seems kind of...
Well, you know, you got to have things in there to give you substance, and with the fruit, you know, I'm going to guess you wouldn't even know it's in there. It's just going to give you some nice flavor profile.
Well, what's the most unusual thing you've seen done with a Twinkie, and I guess beyond the Twinkie hot dog idea, what's more the more unusual things you've seen, both, I guess, edible and non-edible?
Well, one of the things that, people have a difficult time imagining is a Twinkie taco. And when you realize it really isn't a taco and it really doesn't have meat, but it is a dessert version of a taco, you know, your mind goes unique places with the name. But this one's kind of fun. You take the tortilla and you put it in a frying pan with a little butter and get it crisp. Sprinkle it with sugar. Then they take a spread where they've mashed up the Twinkies. Put that on the tortilla. Top it with a little marshmallow whipped topping and a cherry, or you can put Cool Whip, and you have a great little dessert.
So what's your favorite recipe so far?
I really like the beauty shake. It's one of my favorites. One of my favorites for entertaining is the Twinkie kebab. And you just slice the Twinkie like thick coins, maybe a half to an inch thick, and then you can put them on a skewer with fruit. And you know, it's kind of it's a fun way to get your family and your children to enjoy fruit with their meal and have fun at the same time.
You know, there's an old story, an old urban legend out there about people sticking Twinkies into time capsules and making a vow to come back in 50 years, take out the Twinkie and eat it, and prove that it's still fresh and it has an indefinite shelf life. I'm sure you've heard that urban legend.
We have heard that urban legend. We would not recommend that.
So what would happen when they open up a time capsule 50 years on and pull out that Twinkie?
I'm guessing it's going to be very hard. If it's moist, if it's got any moisture left in the package, I would be very surprised. That would depend on the time capsule itself and how airtight it is. It could be moldy if it had moisture left. It's likely to be hard. And you know what? They have a freshness date on them, every package, and that's for a reason, because they're much better eaten fresh.
So how do you think that urban legend came about?
You know, I don't know. We've heard of school teachers that have kept one on their chalkboard tray for years as part of an experiment. You know, that's the fun part of Twinkies, and probably to answer your earlier question, they're used on the science side. I mean, I know people have, you know, there were some college students a few years ago that did a whole series of science experiments based around the Twinkie. And, you know, so food tends to be a common theme many times for the science fair experiments. So maybe that's another reason they're such an icon.
So how many Twinkies do you eat a day?
Do I personally eat a day?
Yeah.
I am not on a daily Twinkie regimen, but I snack at will. There's no bad food. There are just bad quantities. So if I need a sweet treat, a Twinkie's a good option for me.
Now, just between you and me, do you ever just say, you know what, I don't want any Twinkies right now. I've had plenty working with them for 13 years. I think I'm going to have something else.
Well, you know, we do have a lot of options in the hostess line. Now, we have ho-hos and we have cupcakes. So if I need that chocolate fix, you know, there are the chocolate options. And actually, in some parts of the country, we have an item called a chocodile. Not in the Midwest, but on the West Coast, you can buy a chocolate-covered Twinkie, which is the chocodile. And one of the things that we suggest to people that can't find them in their area and would love Twinkies and love chocolate-covered ones even better, you melt a few little chocolate chips in the microwave, put your Twinkie on a wire rack and pour it over the top, and you've got your own version of a chocodile. So if you're a Twinkie fanatic and you want that chocolate hit, that's the way to have both.
So the Twinkie cookbook, when is that coming out?
It'll be out later this year. We're going to accept recipes through the end of March. And Twinkies.com, there's a button, very user-friendly website where you can go and enter your recipe so you can be memorialized in Twinkie history.
That was Teresa Cogswell, Hostess's Blue Ribbon baking expert, talking about the upcoming Twinkie cookbook and Twinkie's 75th anniversary. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. As an 8-year-old, Bill Hammack spent many enjoyable hours with a book on codes and ciphers. But in today's world, he says cryptography is no longer child's play. Our networked computer world depends on it. Everything from a credit card purchase on the web to international banking.
This networked financial world runs only because of a revolutionary breakthrough in cryptography. In the mid-1970s, a handful of young computer wizards invented a new way to encode information. They were distrustful of the government since they'd lived through Vietnam and the Watergate scandal. So they thought deeply about ways to preserve privacy in the emerging computer age. They solved an age-old problem with codes: how to tell the recipient of the coded message how to read it. Julius Caesar, for example, sent messages to his generals encrypted by shifting the letters of the alphabet a fixed amount. But in order for his generals to read the messages, Caesar also had to send along the key by a separate courier, which could be intercepted by enemies. Think of how cumbersome this would be in our internet age. Consider using your credit card to purchase something from a website. If you encrypted your credit card number the way Caesar did, you'd need to also ship the key to the web merchant. It wouldn't be safe to send it in the open via email. You'd have to do something like drive it there or mail it, which might not be secure. To overcome this, these young mathematicians invented public key encryption, which breaks apart the coding and decoding. Here's how it works. I list my public key anywhere, maybe on my website. With this, you can encrypt a message to me. But here's the special part. You cannot then decrypt the message. In fact, you don't need to give me any special instructions about how to read the message. I have instead what's called a private key. I'm the only one that needs to have this. This truly revolutionary separation of encoding and decoding makes possible our web-based internet world. For example, your web browser uses a merchant's public key to encrypt credit card information. Then the merchant uses their private key to read it. No mailing of secret stuff needed at all. Now, of course, like all technological developments, this has a downside. If you can send your credit card information so that prying eyes can't view it, then a terrorist group can plan with the same degree of privacy. This has put cryptography under attack from the U.S. government for years, including banning certain software and even prosecuting its developers. Cryptography seems so exotic and so much the domain of spies and secret agents that we lose sight of how essential it is to our modern everyday world. So like all measures against terrorism, it abridges our freedom whenever we restrict the use of encryption.
The comments of Bill Hammack, who teaches chemical engineering at UIUC. His commentaries on engineering and life, which to him are one and the same, can be found on the web at engineerguy.com. This is Sidetrack. I'm Jason Croft. For 40 years, The Bozo Show was an institution in Chicago, airing on WGN television. Generations of children tuned in to watch the cartoons, the games, like the grand prize game, and the antics of such characters as Cookie, Wizzo, Rusty, Ringmaster Ned, Oliver O'Oliver, Sandy the Tramp, and of course, Bozo himself. When the man who originally played Chicago's Bozo, Bob Bell, retired in 1984, the search went out for his replacement. The man who took over was Joey DeOria. DeOria went on to play Bozo in Chicago for 17 years, up until the show went off the air in 2001. Today, DeOria has taken the skits that were used in the show and written a pair of books, My Favorite Comedy Sketches, Volumes 1 and 2. I talked with him recently and asked him what it was like playing Bozo.
Well, it was a terrific job. My goodness. I think I've never had an acting job where I played one role for so long. It was a tremendous amount of fun. I had no idea what to expect when I first came to Chicago.
Yeah, what was it like putting that makeup on for the first time?
Well, the first time, they had a makeup artist there putting the makeup on for me. That was for my audition that I held at WGN-TV. And I was called in to audition based on a videotape that I had sent the producer. I arrived at the WGN studios, met with Al Hall, Fraser Thomas, Roy Brown, who played Cookie. We read through a script, and Al said, "We'd like to see what you look like in the suit." So they had one of Bob Bell's old costumes there, and I went to a dressing room, and they had a makeup artist who put me in the makeup, and then I got into the suit. And much to my surprise, I just thought they were going to take a few photographs of me. It turns out they had brought in an entire studio audience.
With kids and everything?
Yeah. And we taped my audition with a live studio audience. It seems that the final stage, they had like three or four final applicants for the role, and they videotaped them with a live studio audience to see how they were, you know, how they reacted and how the audience reacted to them.
Wow, and that was it. And then
that was it.
You know, you as Bozo and the show itself was a Chicago institution. It was actually more than just Chicago because GN reached more than just Chicago.
Well, yes, we were on the super satellite, so we were seen all over. In fact, a friend of mine told me that he had actually seen the show while he and his family were vacationing in London one year.
Wow. Well, I mean, there were stories about how long the wait was to get tickets.
Yeah, you know. They had a 10-year waiting list when I arrived.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically a clerical error that started that. When they started the show and people started writing in for tickets, instead of cutting off the list after they had filled their quota for the season, they just let it, you know, they just let the letters and postcards continue to mount up, and then they would pick it up for the second year. And by the third year, they had like, you know, twice as many cards as they needed, and it kept doubling exponentially.
Well, I would hear stories about how people would have a child,
mm-hmm.
and that second that baby was born, they would call up for tickets, because by the time that kid reached the age where they would appreciate the show, they would probably get in.
Oh, yeah. I've even heard stories where there were women who, the minute they became engaged, sent for tickets, because they just figured that by the time the tickets arrived, they would have already had a family started.
Well, it was an interesting thing, since it was this huge institution. You were the guy, the star of the show, but without that makeup on, you were just an ordinary Joe.
Yeah, it was rather interesting. David Letterman was in town taping a show. And I did a whole day of taping with Letterman, and we're driving around Chicago, and at one point, Letterman just kind of stopped, and he looked at me, and he said, "You take off that nose and that wig, and nobody knows who the devil you are, do they?" And I went, "Yeah, pretty much." And he smiled at me, and he said, "Not bad."
Well, that's an interesting question, because, you know, did you feel overshadowed by this character? You know, or was it a relief to, you know, have this normal life outside of Bozo where you weren't recognized at the grocery store and you know, driving around town?
Oh yeah, it was a tremendous relief. Of course, it sometimes really annoy you if you'd go to a restaurant and you're waiting to get in, and, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, Bob Collins or somebody would walk in and they'd usher him right to a table and you'd
right.
go, "Ah, doggone it."
Well, you've taken a lot of what you've done with the Bozo show and sort of the history of comedy, and you've made a couple of books out of it.
Yes. My Favorite Comedy Sketches, which are a series of comedy bits that we did on the show. I have volumes 1 and 2 right now. And these were all comedy routines that we had done on the show. During my years as also head writer on the program, and have put those in script form along with some pointers on how to throw a pie safely, and I included some sketches and prop ideas, and let's see, a little bit of comedy history, and put that together so that people who are with the theater groups or amateur clowns or Boy Scout troops can put on some of the sketches that we did.
Or anybody at home can reenact the Bozo Show.
Exactly. You know, because you can't get tapes, so you might as well put on your own show in your own living room.
So a lot of these sketches, I assume, actually predate the Bozo Show. I'm guessing they're decades and decades old, coming from vaudeville and earlier. Are there variations?
There are variations, yes. There are a couple of them are variations on old vaudeville and burlesque sketches. A lot of them were just original bits that were written around the basic characters at the time. So many cooking sketches were done because of Roy Brown,
who played Cookie the Cook.
Cookie, right. Yeah. So many of the sketches involved the Rusty the Handyman character. So, either you do things where somebody's fixing something or somebody's cooking something.
Well, what makes a good comedy sketch?
Well, it's generally either a misunderstanding or the fact that someone confuses instructions on something, or there is some sort of conflict between the two characters. And that's pretty much what comedy is all about. It's either a misunderstanding or confused instructions, especially when you're writing comedy.
And for comedy and for clowns, it usually ends up with either seltzer down the pants or a pie in the face.
Or a pie in the face. And I must say, there would be days when we would do a show where we didn't throw a single pie, and I discovered that the audiences would be horribly disappointed. I always made sure that whenever I did a sketch, at least one sketch during the course of that show, somebody got a pie.
Well, you guys were known for that, you know, not just the single pie in the face, but the huge pie fights that you would have.
My, yes. In fact, we would have such huge pie fights at the end of the season. A tradition Bob Bell had started was that these pie fights would continue out of the studio, into the hallway, and sometimes down the hall and into the newsroom. I mean...
Did news reporters ever get it?
Oh, heavens, yes. I mean, they...
Now, did this also go on after the taping was over?
Oh, yes. That was it. You know, usually the end of the season, people would sometimes either go home early or take a very long lunch to be nowhere near the Bozo Show set on that last day of taping.
You know, another thing I remember with all those skits and all those pie fights you guys did is you seem to go off script a lot. You seem to just ad-lib and have a lot of fun. Am I thinking correctly? Am I remembering correctly?
Oh, you're remembering very correctly. Basically, the story with us was we would be handed our scripts literally on the day we did the show. And our scripts at the time were not really scripts. They were scenarios.
Mm.
There would be, basically a storyline telling the beginning, ending, you know, the beginning, middle, and end. There might be a few jokes written out so that we would have a joke to go to if we needed it. And that would be it, because we did not have time to memorize scripts. So most of the scripts were ad-libbed. And sometimes we would go off on a tangent. And as Roy Brown used to say, we were handed the scripts, we would read through it one way, we would do our walkthrough for the cameraman and the director another way. We would discuss it in the dressing room another way. And when we got into the studio and the cameras were rolling and the audience was in the bleachers, heaven only knows what we'd do next.
Well, was there ever a time when a sketch just went totally off track?
Oh, heavens, yes.
Yeah?
But sometimes that would be because of
like a prop not working? Or...
Yes, or not being there. We did one bit where Cookie has a head cold.
mm-hmm.
and his head is so stuffed up and congested, he can't hear the alarm on the stove go off to let him know that the turkey dinner was finished. And then Bozo comes in, shuts off the alarm, opens up the stove, and pulls out this turkey that has been spray painted black
mm-hmm.
to show that it had been burned. And the phone rings, and it is supposedly the boss asking if Thanksgiving dinner is ready yet. And Bozo, and this is it. This is where we have the last line written out, which is, "Yeah, boss, it looks like we're going out for Chinese again." Which was, you know, a running gag that every year we never got our Thanksgiving dinner at the circus. We'd always have to go out for Chinese food because
something would happen to the turkey.
Meal.
Yeah.
So the bit was going along perfectly, and the alarm goes off, and Cookie is sneezing and complaining how his head is so stuffed up he can't hear anything. I come in, I start yelling at him, and I turn off the alarm, and I open up the stove, and I pull out the turkey, and of course it's spray-painted black. And I'm saying, look what you did, and I'm waiting for the phone to ring so that I can, you know, deliver that last line. And all of a sudden the phone starts ringing. And we both start looking around, and the stagehands have forgotten to put a phone on the set. And we're looking, and we're looking. And now Roy is breaking up. He's turning his back on the camera, and you see his shoulders shaking because how are we going to get out of this? So I look at the turkey, I pick up the burnt turkey, and I hold it to my ear, and I go, yes. And the young lady that was working the sound effects that day immediately started putting on this little fast chipmunk noise. And I listened, and I went, yes, uh-huh, okay. And I put the turkey back in the frying pan, and I turned to Cookie, and I said, he said he's not done yet. And I put it back in the stove, and that's how we ended the bit.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, well, you know, it was all improv. My producer used to call that the Chicago School of broadcasting.
Now, there's a sad part to this story of the Bozo Show. You stayed on to it to the bitter end when, you know, it was relegated to early Sunday morning and it
right.
was cut down and the format was changed. Was it hard to see the show sort of die off like that?
It was rather difficult. The thing that happened there primarily was the fact that by the end of the show, cable had now become very strong. There were now stations that were fully devoted to children's programming: the Disney Channel, Nickelodeon, the Cartoon Network, and so on. Yes. It was difficult to watch them sort of cut us down, but in the economic market, I could certainly understand why WGN did not want to have to produce in-house programming anymore.
Well, it was kind of sad to see it go, too, of course.
It really was. Believe it or not, I think that if WGN had continued to produce the show, people would still be watching it. I also believe that if they had given us the kind of advertising and a good time slot, I think the show would be as popular, if not more popular, than ever.
So if someone came to you today and offered you a chance to put back on the Bozo makeup, would you do it?
Oh, yeah, well, the only people who would probably offer me that would be WGN.
Well, if they did that, would you do it?
Oh, sure, provided, you know, we can get the old team together. I enjoyed working with Andy Matran, who was our musician on the show, and Robin Urich, who played Rusty the Handyman towards
mm-hmm.
the end of the season. No, those were wonderful days and a tremendous amount of fun.
Hmm. Well, nowadays you've got those books, and you also have a website?
I do, yes, www.mycomedybits.com. And if people are interested in the scripts, they can order them there. They can either order them with a credit card through PayPal, or they can download an order form and send that in with a check or money order, and I can send them out that way.
That was Joey DeOria, who played WGN-TV's Bozo the Clown in Chicago for 17 years. Still to come on the program, a look at a couple of low-powered radio stations that have started up recently in the area. And we remember singer-songwriter Jolie Rickman. Stay tuned. You're listening to Sidetrack. With a preponderance of high-powered FM radio stations owned by conglomerates, there are a handful of groups that are trying to make their voice heard with a meager budget and nowhere near the wattage. AM580's Jeff Bossert visited with the organizers behind two additions to the dial in Urbana, one an FM station that is yet to go on the air, and the other an AM foreign language station that's still searching for an audience.
Just before 10 on a Thursday night in Campus Town, Left Hand, a rock band that came up from Edwardsville, is the first to take the main stage at the Canopy Club. They're among the six regional and local bands that have shown up for the mere publicity, foregoing any kind of payment for tonight's fundraiser gig. 70% of the cover charges for this show will go back into the coffers of WRFU, that stands for Radio Free Urbana. The station is built on the same concept as WEFT, a community radio station that prides itself on allowing those with something to say or their own brand of music to step behind the mic. But organizers don't look at their station as one that will strive to be something else entirely.
I don't think that's really the point. Like, how is it going to be different from WEFT? Well, it's just offering more opportunities for community members to get involved with radio and to get what they want on the radio instead of what, you know, some corporation wants or whatever.
WRFU volunteer Lindsay Melkai booked the bands for the event and has been mainly in charge of fundraising.
I think that's something people always overlook. It's like, oh, well, we have two public radio stations already. Why do we need another one? Why do we need so many for-profit ones, you know?
WRFU may one day provide an alternative to WEFT, but right now it just hopes to go on the air. The group needs to raise $5,000 in order to broadcast, and they have a window of time of about 4 months. The group stands to lose its license if it can't build a transmitter and get on the air by June. If volunteers can get the $5,000, an anonymous donor will match the other $5,000 necessary for a transmitter, antenna, and other equipment. WRFU will broadcast as an extension of the Independent Media Center, partnering with the Socialist Forum, which requested the license for the station back in 2000, and the FCC recently granted a construction permit. John Anderson is one of the volunteers who saw the need for another voice in town.
The people that are involved in this project aren't going in thinking that we're going to put format X or program Y on in any certain particular area. We're going to query the community and ask what they'd like to hear, and hopefully we'll have members of the community that will step up and actually produce things, speak out, and make interesting radio for others to hear.
Anderson dispels any rumors that the station has any programming agenda, political, musical, or otherwise. WRFU will not have a program director. He says the schedule will depend on the best ideas and who comes forward before the station first flips on the transmitter. Some aren't wasting any time. Nathan Schwall came to the station's Canopy Club fundraiser for more than live music. He sought out the station's staff with hopes of doing his own show.
I want to do like a very album-based rock show that features a lot of local groups, a lot of retro stuff such as Flash in the Pan, April Wine. And you go for like kind of more well-known stuff like Nirvana, some U2, some REM here and there. It's kind of scattered along, mostly opposite of what most stations do.
And Anderson says with 24-hour, 7-day-a-week programming, you never know who might find their way on the airwaves.
There was a pastor who showed up at one of our meetings and wanted to put some stuff on the air. He actually wanted to buy advertising. And we told him that we don't do advertising, and you can actually do the programming, and he actually got really excited about that. We had someone else who was involved in I don't know, some sort of community program dealing with Asian folk, and they wanted to do a show, and we told them, yeah, well, when we get the station on the air, you're more than welcome to come, select a time, you know, make a proposal, and follow through, and everyone seems to be really excited about it. They just want it to get here.
One of the priorities in WRFU's call for programming is diversity of voices, and that includes other cultures and foreign language broadcasts. In that respect, they're not the only low-power station looking to reach other populations in and around the University of Illinois campus.
Both dijo que, con la excepción de Sri Lanka, los países afectados no desean ni siquiera la condonación de la deuda, y que han indicado ser...
Latino Radio, which rebroadcasts programs from networks like Radio Netherlands and Voice of America from over the Internet, was the vision of U of I educational psychology professor Gary Zico. He says his idea for an AM Spanish language station in Urbana was born from his love of shortwave radio growing up.
I don't remember exactly how old I was, maybe about 10 years or so. My dad, who was always interested in electronics and radio to some extent, he bought me one of these put-it-together kits, and it turned out to be it was a shortwave radio. And so I hooked that thing together, got it for one Christmas, and put some batteries in, and I was amazed that I was able to, with this little set, hear stations from all over the place. And this is during the Cold War, so I'm hearing, you know, Radio Moscow and Radio Tirana from Albania, or Radio Havana, Cuba, South Africa. And it really opened my eyes up to other countries and other perspectives. And that sort of got me interested in radio in other countries and then other languages. And so I was a shortwave fan for a long time, and I still do listen. But then when the internet came along, and you can get probably hundreds, if not thousands, of different radio stations now on the internet, and, you know, local FM quality, that's pretty exciting. And then the station is sort of a way of sharing that internet possibility with a larger audience in the language that's, you know, second most important in the U.S., which is Spanish.
It's relatively simple. I mean, just a matter of, you know, you don't have a lot of equipment to make this work. Just you're just simply rebroadcasting what's provided online.
Yeah, that's right. The trick is, well, finding a program that will automatically go to the different sources, and I found something to do that. Actually, it's a free program. I may need to get the paid one to do some of the stuff I want to do. But, yeah, it's basically finding the materials out there and finding out when they're broadcast, are they archived, and getting access to it, getting permission to broadcast it. The downside is that, you know, if there's internet traffic and the audio player is waiting 10 or 15 seconds to get it and the program doesn't come through, it may time out and you get an error message. So it'll never be you know, the type of operation that you have over there at WILLAM, where everything is super smooth and, you know, well organized. So there'll be some times when it goes down and there may be a gap of 45 seconds between programs and this type of thing. But other than that, it really is sort of a new way to do a radio station. If you're interested in international broadcasting, it's all there for, you know, to listen to.
Latino Radio broadcasts at 1660 on the AM dial. Zico hopes to one day incorporate local talk and news programs. The January 20th fundraiser for WRFU raised around $500 to add to a few thousand that it's already amassed from donations. The volunteers plan on holding a few more similar events, but at last check, the station, which will broadcast from 104.5 FM at 100 watts, was about $1,300 short of what was needed to meet the June air deadline. Volunteers for Radio Free Urbana meet the first and third Tuesdays of the month at the Independent Media Center at 218 West Main. For more information, email WRFU at rfu@ucimc.org. I'm Jeff Bossert.
You've got attuned to Sidetrack. Last month, the Central Illinois Banjo Club donated 75 ukuleles to three elementary schools in Morton, Illinois. They did this to introduce the students to fretted instruments, like guitars and banjos. I talked recently with Ed Corey, a banjo player himself and a member of the group. I asked him to tell us a little bit more about the organization and their ukulele donation.
This came about from some of our members, and I've attended a few of the FIGA conventions.
And what is that?
FIGA stands for Fretted Instrument Guild of America. Takes in all stringed instruments that have frets on them, which are the little lines going across the neck of your instrument, and that's where you place your fingers within between those frets, and that's how you get your different tones. These are national conventions, and we've talked to other members of other groups, and they've started some of these programs with the youth. A lot of stringed instruments, you don't hear much about them anymore, especially the banjo. They're kind of an instrument that is not very popular with the young kids. And so what we want to introduce to these grade schoolers are the sing-along music and also the stringed instrument.
So what prompted you guys to do this donation of ukuleles?
Well, first of all, we are a nonprofit organization. Last year, last summer, we produced a CD, and we've been selling those CDs, and the sales are going very well. And from the proceeds, we have to use that money to a good cause. And so after hearing about these other organizations around the country doing this, we thought we would start this ourselves.
Well, why ukuleles? Because you're a banjo club, and you're giving out ukuleles. It's kind of like, you know, a Ford dealer giving out Chevy cars or something.
Well, that's true. It would be easy for them to handle the ukuleles. These are baritone ukuleles, and the chord structure on them is exactly the same chord structure that they would use on a guitar. And most of our members in our club, the Central Illinois Banjo Club, are guitar tuned, what they call guitar tuned. And so the chord structure that they learn on the ukuleles will allow them to move on to a guitar or a banjo, hopefully a banjo.
So you have your biased, of course.
Yes, yes.
So tell us a little bit about this organization, the Central Illinois Banjo Club.
We are about 7-8 years old. It started out with about four members who used to play at the Conklin Theater in Goodfield, Illinois. And they used to have a weekly show there called Love's Rides the Rail. And these members played there. They would play prior to the performance, and they would play during break time. And so then they thought, these four members thought that they would form a banjo club. And from there, we're up to 60 members right now.
That's an awful lot of banjo players.
Right, right. Now, we have some who are members, but may not, we don't see them very often. At our practice, we normally have around 30 players. When we recorded this CD, we had 40 members involved, and that included that required us to get together on a weekly basis for practice, and we did that for a number of weeks and months, you know, prior to producing the CD.
Wow, that's a lot of banjo players together in one place.
Okay, and I must go a little bit further.
Okay,
we have some guitar players. Couple guitar players within our group. We have about three mandolin players. We have a fellow that he's very versatile. He can play the piano, he plays trumpet, he plays a cornet, trombone, and sometimes he brings those instruments to add just a little bit different sound to our music.
Well, what is it about the banjo that you think makes it such a great instrument?
It brings happiness to people. I want to point out one example. A lot of our gigs are played in nursing homes. And a couple years ago, for example, we were at Maple Lawn Nursing Home in Eureka. After our performance, the activity director came over and she pointed out a particular man in the wheelchair, which, of course, there's a number of residents there in wheelchairs. But she said that man had been there 8 weeks, hadn't said a word all those 8 weeks. But that night he sang every song and tapped his foot and hands, you know, to every song that we played. It just brings the good and the fun out of people. We can go to a practice, maybe feeling down ourselves, but once we get there, it just puts you in a great, great mood.
Well, a lot of people will admit that they're not big fans of banjo music. And what can you say to somebody to maybe convince them otherwise?
Well, to be honest with you, I haven't found anyone like that, but I guess
well, of
people
course
that
not.
Come
You're...
to our... I'm sorry.
Well, of course not. You're in a banjo club.
Right. And I guess the people that come to our gigs probably are interested in banjo music. But I would tell them, actually, the banjo is probably America's only instrument. And what this instrument came from probably Africa. It was somewhat of a tambourine type instrument without a neck on it, and from it was developed, the banjo was developed here in our own country. That doesn't convince someone to like the music, but I think most people, again, I'm speaking of maybe people above 40, 50 years old, when they hear our sing-along music like 5 Foot Two and Four Leaf Clover and Angry and some of these other songs, Whispering, it just brings something out of them. I think it recalls their youth. And I think most times in our memories, we remember the better times about our youth.
So what other activities does the Central Illinois Banjo Club have in store?
In store?
Yeah.
We play at some of the local fairs, like we played at Washington's Cherry Festival. We have played at the Heart of Illinois Fair. We go to Raritan, Illinois once a year. They have an opera house that's over 100 years old, and they call us back every year. We play there. It isn't very often we travel that far because we don't get anything. We have a fee, but the members themselves do not get anything out of this.
If people want to find out more about the Banjo Club or have a banjo and want to join in, where should they go for more information?
I do the scheduling. My phone number is 309-367-2786. And again, my name is Ed Corey. The president of our group is Denny Overstreet. He lives in Morgan. His number is 309-263-2518.
That was Ed Corey of the Central Illinois Banjo Club. He was talking about the group and their recent donation of 75 ukuleles to three elementary schools in Morton, Illinois. You're listening to Sidetrack. Recently, we learned of the passing of singer, songwriter, activist Jolie Rickman. Rickman was a graduate of the University of Illinois, and although she lived in New York, she returned here often to perform. We featured her on the program back in 2000. She had just released her album, Suffer to Be Beautiful. She talked about the title track and about some of the women who inspired her other songs.
I went in as a 10-year-old to get a perm and had all these things in my hair. Kill! I'm curious about the whole idea of beauty and how to reclaim, how to claim our power to define what beauty is.
Mm-hmm.
Within the folk scene right now, and within much of the music scene, there's a fear of politics, anything political, although it's becoming a little bit less so in the last year, maybe these days, especially in light of all the actions that are going on and the activism that's becoming much more of a populist thing, that people are really interested to hear, you know, things that aren't just solely about the artist's love life or just art for art's sake.
This is a song about a woman, a really cool, radical, wonderful woman named Peg Millett, who is an environmental activist on the West Coast and who participated in an action with an affinity group, an environmental affinity group of five people. They went to destroy some power lines that were connected with a nuclear power plant, which they were not in favor of. They went to dismantle these power lines, and when they got to the place they were going to do it, they got arrested and put in the jail by the FBI. This song is a dedication to Peg Millett because she served all these years in jail while this man who had actually seduced her and became her lover and participated in the action with her went back to the FBI. Oh, Peg, where you been, where you been, where you been? You've been doing some time for your government's sin. Oh, Peg, where'd he go, where'd he go, where'd he go? Is he back in the arms of the COINTELPRO? Well, I wish I could smash him upside of the head with this pretty guitar and make him be dead. But, Peg, if it's all just a part of his plan, then I damn him with music instead. Oh, Peg. Is it true? Did you blow the shit up cause some boy told you to? Or did he cry war? Did your nature fight back? Did your man scream for more? Well, I wish I could smash him upside of the head with my pretty guitar and make him be dead. But Peg, if it's all just a part of his plan, then I'd damn him with music instead. I'm community-based in the sense of I'm based in a community of peace and justice and change makers. And so I sort of sing about things that come out of my community. Thanks. This is called Emma Goldman, being one of my heroes, Emma Goldman, and Rosa Parks, Rosa Luxemburg. And it's also about my community. Sometimes I wander through this old abandoned town, filled with the misery of time wasted, filled with fear of population zero, filled with the history of war. You show up and you smile for no reason, like it's all so simple and clear, like we're the hope of 100 generations, like you and I have no fear, like we are rocking in the soul of Emma Goldman, like we're Rosa's pride, like we are stronger than your average superhero, like we're an ocean wide. Emma Goldman elevated women within the union movement, the anarchist movement.
represent the progressive movement of the early turn of the century. She really critiqued things like borders and immigration policy. This was back in the turn of the century. She really critiqued the power in the hands of the industrial leaders and the capitalists and the corporate owners. And she really advocated for the rights of the workers. She would go to strikes all over the place.
I was supposed to go and fight and win. And these words have no meaning to me.
This was a song that kind of tried to rock me back into my spirit and keeping me where I know I belong. And so I wrote it kind of as a raw, as I'm thinking about rocking in the soul of Abraham. Sometimes I was raised with all these kind of Christian songs, not really practicing Christian at all anymore, or Catholic anymore. So sometimes I reclaim some of them. So I thought of rocking in the soul of Abraham and how comforting that used to be to me. So I thought rocking in the soul of Emma Goldman.
Rocking in the soul of Emma Goldman, like we are roses, pride, like we are stronger than your average superhero, like we're an ocean wide.
That was the song Emma by Jolie Rickman. Rickman passed away on January 19th in New York. She was 34. That feature was produced by WILL's Kimberly Chronic and was originally aired in 2000. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website. And a lot of our past shows are also available as MP3 downloads. Just go to will.uiuc.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.